This is the Non Sequitur Show, where bold ideas are righteous, unique perspectives are gospel, and strong opinions are sacred. Season 1, Episode 6. Candid, nothing but the truth. With special guest and former host of the Fundamentally Flawed podcast, Alex Botton. Join in on the discussion and check out upcoming episodes at www.nonsexshow.com. That's NONSEQ show.com. And now, here are your hosts, Kyle Curtis and Steve McRae.
Here we are again, beautiful people. My name's Kyle Curtis. I am actually not joined by Steve McRae today. Steve is in the middle of moderating a debate on his channel, so we wish him well in that, and he will be back next week. Today, I'm actually joined by Alex Botton, and if any of you are familiar with the debate scene on YouTube, Alex Botton will be no stranger to you. He also hosted a very popular podcast called Fundamentally Flawed, in which he had conversations with theists, sometimes very heated ones, but nonetheless very, very interesting indeed. What Alex is doing now is perhaps one of the most honest and insane tasks anyone could take on. With ink and paper, Alex has set out to rewrite history. His history, as it actually happened. Now think about that. Every thought, every secret, every action recorded as it was before friendships, emotions, and tact tamed the beast we call truth. What do you say we go ahead and get into it? First of all, Alex, thank you for joining me today. I really appreciate it. Tell everyone what exactly you're doing and the motivation behind this project.
Where can I start? Well, I'll start with where I initially got the idea. A couple of years ago, myself and my partner went to the Cheltenham Literary Festival. And we went to see, amongst all the talks we went to see the Norwegian author Karl Ove Knausgård, who has been writing a book called My Struggle for the last several years. And I hadn't read any of it at the time that we saw him, but it kind of made me think, oh, maybe I should write down everything that I can remember that's ever happened to me. Because the whole notion with My Struggle was that it was an autobiographical work. So I decided that as a way of kind of remembering everything that's happened to me in case I could go senile when I'm old, and also in a way of taking control of various events in my life, I'd just try and write down everything I could remember happening. So I started writing this book. So it's a kind of, I guess, almost like an autobiographical novel. And it's the intention was to be as brutally honest with myself and about myself as I could be, which is what I've tried to do with it. And some of it's quite uncomfortable to write, and I'm sure that for some people it'll be uncomfortable to read. There's things that I'm going to have to really think about very carefully before I make it kind of more widely available, you know, whether I change people's names and things like that. But yeah, it's a... Yeah, it's kind of getting the thoughts inside your head, the things you don't say, kind of outside, and then hoping that other people have the same kind of thoughts and that you're not a psychopath.
I think that's where that's what I find most fascinating, because the more that I thought about it, I think that you're dead on with thinking that other people think the same way, you know, because I was thinking about myself. We tend to gloss over, or when we're having conversations with other actual people, the events kind of get skewed in a little bit to make them less real, or, you know, less mm-hmm. awkward, or less frustrating. But if you were by yourself and you had to tell yourself what happened in, you know, in said event, I think that it would be almost a completely different story, because what really happened and then what we say happened in events is a lot of times mitigated by our relationship with that particular person.
Yes, absolutely. I think there's a certain amount of it's that we the way, and I think this is probably where you're going with this, is that we remember things from our perspective. So events that I've written about in the book may well not be remembered the same way by the other parties involved at all. So it's kind of important to make it clear that it's my recollections of it rather than it being the definitive recollections of it. But it's my responses to it and my thoughts about it at the time. And yeah, I don't know if that makes it any clearer.
I don't know if this is brilliant or I don't know if this is almost like a suicide mission, because there are going to be people that, like you just said perfectly, they remember that same situation differently. So by reading a completely raw, completely unfiltered, no worries about anyone else's feelings, which I think is important because it's almost got to be kind of cathartic for you. However, on their side, it's going to look like a completely different situation. And so you mentioned earlier that you haven't decided if you're going to change the names yet or not. Is there really a possibility you might keep the actual names of the parties involved?
That's the hope. I've been very conscious of that almost from when I started writing it. So there's certain people that I haven't named in it. The main person that I don't name in it is my first wife.
Right.
I just refer to her once as my first wife and then as MFW from then on. And purely because in all the situations that, you know, she was involved in, she was an innocent party. And there's nothing she's ever done that's kind of warrants being dragged through the mud and being named at all. So it's a really difficult thing because I'm kind of conscious that it could cause some colossal problems if I leave all the names as they are. yeah. I mean, I've had to be careful not to write about certain things. And there's a little section in it where I talk about not writing about certain events that I know to be true, but it's either not my place to say it or I haven't been able to corroborate it beyond a level that I'm satisfied with. I mean, one of the examples is the deputy headmaster at my secondary school when I was in Nuneaton. Mm-hmm. The story is that eventually he was imprisoned for being a prolific paedophile. But ooh. Though I've had this confirmed to me by other students and saying, yes, it was in the papers and stuff, but it was, you know, a bit of a cover up by the school, I can't find anything online to corroborate it. So I don't want to name the guy. So I haven't. And there's another guy in there that was somebody I went to school with who slept with his underage girlfriend when he was, you know, in his late teens. And again, that's something that, you know, there's a technical aspect of what that makes that person, but it isn't my place to name that person. You know, that technically that person is absolutely just, you know, if you're going to look at it black and white and by definitions of the law, that person is a statutory rapist and a paedophile. But
right,
the situation itself is more complicated.
Absolutely. And
it's not my place to name that person. So, and I've not kind of even tried to heavily implicate anybody. I'm kind of, you know, it's a fine line with some things. Whereas with other people, I've written about them quite candidly. And as it goes on, the stuff that's coming up that's far more candid, and it's going to get more terrifying as I get nearer to the present day, because then I'm writing about people who are currently in my life.
Oh.
Yeah, work colleagues and things like that. And that's where there's an anxiety attached to the whole thing.
I can imagine so. The part that I have up until you and Joe's breakup. So
yes,
and before then was intense. I mean, the whole thing is fascinating. And if you say that it gets more enthralling, I can't imagine what that's going to be like, because this first half it was just great. Before we go into kind of the specific stories, is there mm-hmm. anybody that is in the book or that you're going to write about that knows that this project is going on or that you're writing this book?
A couple of work colleagues are aware that I'm writing it and that they may well be in it. Right at the very, very start, I mentioned one of my work colleagues. She's aware that she's in it because she was the person who said, oh, why don't you actually do it, after I'd been kind of like not doing it for like a year or so.
Is she going to regret that?
No, she's read that bit and she's, you know, fine about it. And another one of my former work colleagues who's now left to have a baby, she features in it early on when I'm talking about death. And she read the section that she's in and was quite happy with what I'd written, and she said, you know, that was a fair description of what she'd felt about the death of her partner and the conversations her and I had had about it. But yeah, there's some people that are completely unaware that I'm writing this thing. It's going to be an interesting experience to see how they react to it. The thing is, I'm conscious that even if I change the names, people who read it will know who they are in it, even though other people don't know who they are.
Oh, that's true.
So I'm in this awful situation where, you know, I can change somebody's name to Davey.
Oh, yeah, that's a good
from,
point.
You know, from Clive or whatever. And that just through the description of the interactions, they'll know who I'm talking about. So it's a really difficult situation to be in, because I want to finish it and I want people to be able to read it.
But you're, at the same you're screwed either way.
Yeah. So I'm having to, I'm conscious that certainly when I get to writing about work colleagues and about my current job, I'm going to have to be a little bit more, is it circumspect about it? I have to be a little bit more careful with how I write things, because ultimately I still need to have a job.
Absolutely.
I'm hoping that nothing in there so far, I don't think I've written anything particularly awful about my parents or my brother. And I think I've been quite kind of, my grandparents have all passed away now. So there's no risk of upsetting them. But
right.
I think there's certain things that, I mean, I've talked about it with my youngest son, and I've told him that some of the stuff that's coming up is really, you know, it's going to be very, very difficult reading. But I'm hoping that as the person I reserve the most criticism for is myself, that I might be able to get away with it.
I mentioned a second ago that I could kind of see why someone would do this, because it could be kind of cathartic. But then just now when we're talking about whether you change the names or whether you don't change the names, you're kind of in the same boat. It almost seems like this would be almost too stressful of a thing to do. You know what I mean? It's like what you're doing is trying to get to the truth. You're trying to find your truth. You're trying to, you know, put your thoughts on paper. But at the same time, you're having to wage war with, how do I word this? And is this going to offend this person? So it's almost like there's this ultimate struggle, you know, back and forth between truth and offending someone.
Yeah, it is difficult, because I have set myself the task of being brutally honest, and the ultimate risk is that if, you know, I mean, the likelihood of it is, and I'm not, you know, fooling myself about it at all, the likelihood is that hardly anybody will read it, and it'll be, it'll be a big nothing, and nothing will come of it. But, you know, there's always that tiny chance that it could become something that a lot of people read. And that's the risk. You know, do I self-edit all the time and write conscious of how other people would receive it? Or do I stick to my initial plans and write very candidly about everything that's happened? It's a tricky one. I think it's important to write candidly about it, but I'm also conscious that that is going to, most likely, it is going to burn some bridges with people.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a very high chance that people I genuinely care about may not want to speak to me once they've read it. And also, the things I'm kind of revealing about myself, it's absolutely, you know, warts and all. There's nothing that I'm hiding about what I've done in my life. And part of doing that was the cathartic thing, because it then takes back control of those events. And I can say, you know, if somebody goes, oh, I found out you did this, it's like, well, it's in the book. I've written about that already. What else have you got? You know, so there'll be nothing that anybody can dig up on me,
right?
Because it will all be in there. You know, even the stuff that, you know, most people would go, yeah, I'm never telling anybody that. This is a scary thing about it, is writing down the things that I've never told people. And it makes me feel sick sometimes thinking about what I'm writing and what's coming up. But I've been doing it since May now. So I think I've kind of got used to it.
I don't see how you could get used to that sinking feeling almost. With the possibility of you burning bridges and possibly losing relationships that are meaningful to you, would it be worth it?
It's a difficult one, because I think it's something I have to do,
mm-hmm.
and I have to see it through and finish it. And I'm hoping that the positives that could potentially come out of it would outweigh the personal cost. By that I mean that the positives that other people take from reading it who aren't, you know, immediately involved, that they may get something from it and go, well, hang on a second, my life's, you know, like that, and I think like that, and so it's fine to think like that. It's almost like giving people permission to realize that they're like everybody else in a lot of ways, you know, because there's all the things that we all do in our lives that everybody can think of something that they've done that they're so toe-curlingly ashamed of, that or they think that they've broken the law, or they think that this thing has been like the most immoral thing they could possibly have done, and, you know, the kind of thing that would bring down the absolute it's not really anger, the kind of, it would bring down colossal disapproval from their peers, and it would affect their standing, their social standing amongst their peers. Everybody's got things like that, but they don't want to verbalize them and they don't want to express them. And maybe by writing those things from my point of view, then other people can go, okay, it's all right. That thing I did 20 years ago that still gnaws at me doesn't actually matter. So that's maybe one of the benefits. I mean, maybe I'm blowing smoke up my own ass thinking that, and that all I'm doing is a colossally egocentric splurge of just, you know, whatever's going on in my head that isn't going to do anybody any good and will end up making me a friendless loser sitting in a room on my own, you know, with nobody wanting to speak to me. But,
oh man, it's almost like you're ahead of me in terms of where I'm going, because you literally just answered my next question, which I understand the need to want to put this on paper and find your own truth, but why make it public? You know, why let those people have access to where they can read it? And you literally just answered that question. So,
yeah, I mean, there's another element to it as well. There's, you know, there's the you know, that kind of almost, I don't, again, this is the thing, because I'm having to think it through whether what my motives are for it, you know, and this is what it's caused me to do a lot of the time, is that since I've started writing, I now consider, am I thinking this way because of this or that? You know, I've just spun it as if it could hopefully be an altruistic thing that could help other people, but it might just be this complete attention-seeking arrogance. And, you know, the, hey, look at me, read this, learn all about my amazing life. And it could be that. And I'm kind of conscious that that could be part of what's going on there. I hope it isn't, but there's a chance that it is.
That's very honest. And it's,
you know, it's a very self-centered thing to do. It's a very selfish thing to do. And I can try and paint it as being selfless as much as I want and say, oh, it's this noble thing I'm doing for the betterment of mankind. It probably isn't. It's probably something that I'm doing entirely for myself that runs the risk of genuinely hurting other people. But I'm still going to do it even knowing that. And that almost makes it worse in a way, that I'm aware that it could hurt people and I'm still doing it.
But I think that, like I said, I've gone back and forth on both ends of the spectrum. But ultimately, what I came down on is that yes, it may hurt. It may hurt some people. Yes, some people may not like what it says. But ultimately, everyone has the situations that you're in, the situations where you think something and you don't say it out loud, but mm-hmm. you're still thinking it. And I don't care who you are or where you come from, what you believe. Everyone has had that happen to them. So mm-hmm. where they might get mad at you for, you know, that just being whatever that situation was, ultimately they've had, you know, similar thoughts or similar situations or, you know, periods where something's happened and they didn't say what they were thinking. So really, I mean, no one can get mad at you if you think about it that way.
Mm. Well, I'm let's hope so. It's a tricky one. While you were saying that, I was just trying to think about how people can feel about it and who's involved. And I am conscious that even with this first draft of it, when, you know, this is really kind of like the blast it all out and then go back over it stage, I'm still doing a little bit of trying to pull my punches with some people. again, but then the other side of it as well is that I'm conscious that I'm writing things that literally nobody knew until I wrote them down. You know, things that were complete secrets, usually between me and one other person, and things that were kept secret. And that's going to get worse as things go on. And there's going to be more of that kind of thing. Because, again, this is something that people may have taken me into their confidence over things. But if I then decide to write about that, then I'm betraying the confidence. But it's a difficult one, because I guess I'll have to weigh it up on a case by case basis. But I'm conscious that there are going to be certain events that only me and one other person are aware of. You know, and it's not one specific person. It's, you know, various different people throughout my lives in these situations. But yeah, there's going to be that where if I read somebody writing things that I'd done without my permission, then I'd possibly get quite upset about it. It's a really tricky one, Carl. I'm not.
It is. It's fascinating.
I'm just shooting myself. Yeah.
I think that what you're doing, I think, brings up a conversation that people could just have for hours. The entire idea of it, I just think, is genius in a way, and also suicidal.
Yeah, it's horrifying. It's absolutely horrifying. Over the years, I've done lots and lots of kind of various creative projects, you know, visual art and music and things like that. And this is the first thing I've done that actually scares me.
And those are the things, though, that people remember, and that change things. You know what I mean? Like, and I think that's where what you're going to find. Like an idea like this is something that is so radical, and just something that people would just never do, because why would you do that? And I think that's going to really kind of resonate with people. And one of the things that I liked about it the most is kind of the honest dialogue that you have with yourself, because there's a back and forth that goes on with yourself.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's something I made a decision to do, that when I reached certain points, if I found myself thinking a certain thing about it as I wrote it, I would then follow that thought and I'd write that down and kind of question myself, you know, in real time.
That's brilliant.
While I was writing, and kind of go back and saying, well, you know, do we think this way? Is this something that should be done? I mean, I think there's one bit, and I don't know if it's in the part you've got or later, but I write something and then the next, and I felt what I'd written was weirdly clunky and very oddly worded. And I write saying that last bit was weird. Yep. You know, it's almost as much about writing as everything else. It's about the act of writing. And, you know, it drops into the present day in some points, and I write about the events that are happening to me on the day that I'm writing it. And then it drops back into something 25 years ago or 30 years ago or whatever. It's kind of hops back and forth. But I've tried to keep it fairly chronological. But yeah, there's that kind of inner dialogue thing going on.
What jumped out to me was kind of a feeling that goes along with the theme of the entire project. Mm-hmm. Your dialogue with yourself is almost sometimes questioning why you're saying this out loud.
Yeah, I could have just gone very kind of straightforward. I did this, then I did this, then I did this, then I did this. And I would find that boring to read. So I'm kind of conscious that, I mean, there's certain things that I've not written about. I've not written about every single thing I've ever done. There's no doubt as I go on with it, I may find myself leaving out things that really mean something special to me. Because I want to keep them as something special, which weirdly would kind of defeat the object of it, because if I then, you know, go senile in my old age, those really precious memories will be lost to me. So maybe I should put them all in. But I'm having to walk that line between how much of myself am I willing to share and how much of myself do I want to keep for myself afterwards. I mean, it's not something that I'm going to keep on going as a day-to-day thing once I hit the present day. There's a distinct end point that I've got in mind for it. So everything past that point will still be, you know, mine, but everything up to that point will kind of effectively have become, you know, almost some public domain. It'll be just given out for everybody. And there's nothing remotely special or different about my life than anybody else's. But I'm hoping that if people do read it, they'll realize that their lives are special in a way that everybody's is. That day-to-day mundane stories of what we do with our lives are actually, you know, they're kind of, you know, when we look back at them, we kind of see them as a narrative. And we imagine the shape of our lives as a narrative. And maybe it'll help people kind of go, okay, yeah, that's all right for me to feel like that.
I think because it's something that you're not used to reading, you know, that level of honesty. So to be able to kind of be in a, it was like literally being Alex Botton for.
Yeah, I'm glad that that's what's coming across, because that's part of what I'm wanting it to do, is to kind of give people an insight into what it's like to be somebody else.
Now, let's talk about some particular parts of the book. One of the things that, just as an aside note, I find a sign of the times, I guess, if you will, the story of Mr. Lunt.
Yes. He was my teacher in my second year of junior school. So that would have been my sixth year in education. So what would I have been? Maybe 10 at that age, or maybe 9 or 10. And there was a guy in the class called Barry. And I won't use his surname in this because I don't know whether I'll keep it in the book as that. But we'll just refer to him as Barry at the moment. And Barry was quite a troubled kid and had come from a kind of school that had a reputation for having troubled kids. And he would rile Mr. Lunt quite regularly, and he was quite a kind of aggressive kid. And one day he pushed Mr. Lunt to breaking point, which, to the shock of myself and my classmates, Mr. Lunt just kind of vaulted over this table, grabbed Barry and sort of smacked him against the wall. And everybody was like, whoa. Barry got sent off to the headmaster, and there was a dent in the wall in the panel because he'd really bashed him hard against it. And I think he'd almost gone to punch him and had punched the wall instead to stop himself. But he was a very mild mannered, middle aged man, you know, grey hair, quite a kind of dowdy looking fella. And he just lost it just for those few moments.
Today, that would not be anywhere close. Well, as a matter of fact, he didn't even get reprimanded, did he? He didn't get suspended or anything.
No, Barry didn't get suspended. Mr. Lunt didn't get suspended.
That's insane.
It was just, yeah, I mean, this is, it was a different world. I mean, that would have been the early 80s, and it was a very, very different. I don't know, there were certain things you could get away with as a teacher that now there'd be no hope of getting away with those things.
No.
But and I suppose kids today have no comprehension that their teachers could have been like that. And, you know, maybe they're kind of awful to their teachers now, and the teachers aren't in a situation to be able to kind of impress their authority upon the kids,
right,
because they don't have the free rein that they had back in the 70s and 80s, you know, 50s, 60s, 70s and 80s. I mean, I think it's right that teachers aren't, you know, slamming children into walls. You know, this is a grown, middle-aged man smacking a 8 or 9 year old into a wall. You know, there's no justification for that. But at the same time, it's what happened, and you can understand it from his point of view that he lost it. His kid
absolutely
that was needling him and needling him and needling him. You know, there was wrong on both sides. But yeah, there's just no way. The teacher would be suspended or fired nowadays.
I wonder, it makes me wonder if, you know, how that ultimately affects how they are as adults. You know what I mean? Like, while I don't feel that you should, you know, be slamming kids against walls, I almost feel like that was like a wake-up call maybe for Barry, and he may have had a change in, you know, attitude and how he acted towards people of authority. But nowadays, everything is so, you know, bubble wrapped. And I wonder if that's going to mold a generation of just people who run over everyone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's crazy, because I mean, I suppose it puts you in a situation where if everybody's quite kind of polite to each other and very much consider the feelings of other people all the time and try not to get into confrontations, the minority of people who don't care about that kind of thing are, as you say, can be just able to ride roughshod over everybody and steamroll their way into being into positions of power and bullying people and stuff. And it may lead to a generation where they haven't got the toolkit to deal with bullying, that they don't know how to deal with it or how to deal with aggression from somebody else.
Right.
Yeah, and we'll just go, oh, no, you can't do this. And I think it's something that comes out a lot with the way, you know, some people talk about social justice warriors and their need for safe spaces. I think there's an element of this idea that people are too mollycoddled. But then it's, are we thinking that in light of our own upbringings? You know, I mean, I can't even begin to imagine what it must be like being a child now or being a teenager now. I'm certainly, from the point of view of being in secondary school now or high school in the States, I'd hate that now. If I was going through that now with the internet, and, you know, all these ways of, you know, the bullying comes home with you.
Very good point.
And, you know, you start getting WhatsApp messages in the middle of the night from people calling you names and stuff, and it must be appalling. Whereas when I was at school, you know, you left it, you got home, and you were in your safe home environment.
Very good point.
And that doesn't exist anymore, and you can make terrible mistakes. You know, you see about these kids that send explicit photographs of themselves to each other, and that's the kind of thing kids do, because kids have no concept that that could be seen as being really bad. And then they end up on, you know, sex offenders registers and things like that. And it's right. It's a minefield that the mistakes that my generation was able to make, and the mistakes that any generation going through that period of their lives up until the advent of the internet, those mistakes were forgotten. There was no record of those mistakes. Whereas now, you know, somebody does something or somebody comes to a position of prominence and they go back through their Facebook feed and their Twitter feed and people find things they've said 10 years ago. I'd hate that. I'd hate if people could find things that I'd said when I was like, you know, 12. Because I said some stupid shit when I was 12.
Imagine, like, look at what happened with Kevin Spacey and these celebrities, where from stuff that happened almost 20 years ago that are being brought up are ending these people's career. Can you imagine having that on record, on digital record? And what you do in middle school, you know, can get you fired from a corporation 40 years later. I mean, that's...
Well, absolutely. I mean, this is the thing. I mean, somebody like Kevin Spacey is in a position where there's no physical record of that thing having happened.
Right.
So he can still deny it, you know. It's, and that they can, those people who are in those trouble, whether they've done it or not, and my feeling is that they have, but they'll always have that ability to say, well, I didn't do it. And they'll always have a small number of people who will go, no, he didn't do it, I still support him. But if you've got it there, you know, as a record of it happening with your voice and your face and it happening, a recording of the event, then
that's crazy.
There's no denying that. And kids don't seem to get that what they're doing is throwing all this information about themselves into the world that will be there forever, which is a bit of an irony considering that's what I'm doing with the book.
I was getting ready to say that. I wrote down on my notepad right here, I said, you're literally waving your indictment papers in the air.
Yeah. But the thing is, I mean, I suppose from my point of view is I'm doing it consciously and I'm aware of the ramifications and the possible fallout from it. It's not something that I'm just doing because I'm a kid and that's what kids do. And I think I think to be in a situation where all the things you've ever done that were bad are permanently recorded without it being something you've decided to make public, I think that's an awful situation to be in. I mean, I'm in a very, very different situation to that because I've got control over what stories I tell. Though I'm trying very hard to be very honest about myself, probably something in my subconscious is stopping me writing certain things. But you know, with the kids, he's got all their stuff, you know, that they just typed on Twitter and like in spur of the moment, or stuff they splurged out on Facebook. You know, a good example, I think everybody does it. They open Facebook in the morning and it has the on this day thing. And you go back, you go, oh, I wonder what I was doing a year ago. And you go back and it's starting to get to like, you know, 10 years ago. And you go back, you go, oh God, I can't believe I wrote that.
Yes.
And, you know, that's stuff as an adult that I've written. It's like, you know, even stuff I've said a few years ago, you know, poorly worded things or things that I've known that I didn't mean a certain way but came across that way. You know, I still kind of cringe about them. But yeah, it must be a nightmare being in a situation where you can make that happen to yourself.
You see all these doors that you're opening here by what you're doing.
This is it. I mean, if it's something that causes people to have these conversations, then that's maybe got some value. You know, maybe I can fool myself into thinking that there's a positive outcome in that way. But it's
true. Know, it's true.
Yeah.
And also a theme in your book that is very strong against religion. Can you kind of go through kind of that tone in the book? Because I noticed that when you get to those particular parts, it's very sharp, especially with the original sin.
Yeah, you know, I was brought up, my parents were religious, so I was brought up in a religious household. And there was a lot of things I hated about it, but it was more the kind of social side of it. And, you know, I think as anybody who's brought up religious, I just accepted that it was true. But, you know, there are certain things as I got older that made less and less sense. And the notion, like you say, about the original sin thing, the original sin is such an obscene idea. The idea that I'm guilty of something that somebody did, you know, 200 years ago. Again, I mean, you can bring it into today's world where, you know, there's a debate about whether Americans should be paying reparations to the descendants of slaves. And it's a really difficult situation because the people living now had nothing to do with what happened then. But you can make the argument that there should be something paid and some kind of form of collective apology. But I don't think there's any need for the individual to take responsibility for it. And I think maybe, you know, you'll get some people on the right will say, oh, you know, this is why are they apologizing for it? I think they don't understand that it's a group apology. It's an apology on behalf of a group that is maybe not there to apologize anymore. And they're not taking personal responsibility for what happened, but they are saying this happened. It's awful. It's people who were in the past have led to me, and on their behalf, I apologize.
I think that was very well said for something that is a very raw, very, very kind of pushed under the rug, I think, issue, because there seems to be a tendency in this country to try to turn away and push back in the closet that entire period. You know, like it's not anything that people want to talk about. It's not something that we want to acknowledge. And I think what that does is cause a bigger rift. I think by ignoring that that period in time happened and not saying that it was wrong publicly and making sure that there is no question that that was wrong and that we were wrong on that that side of it, that it's almost like a pressure cooker because there's tension between two sides, a side that doesn't want to own up to what happened and then a side that is saying, why won't you just admit that you did this?
Well, I think I make one of the examples in the book I make is about the child born in Germany today has got no more responsible for the Holocaust than I am for, you know, Adam sinning. I think Germany's maybe a good example that children in Germany, as far as I know, are brought up being fully aware of what happened. It's not glossed over in their history lessons. They aren't told that it was some kind of, you know, wonderful thing that happened. They've taken full responsibility for it. And as a result, within Europe, everybody, you know, within those countries, you know, as much as you can, gets on. You know, it's there isn't that negative feeling against Germany from the rest of Europe that there could have been if Germany had gone, no, we didn't do anything. What's it to do with us?
Right.
They've taken full responsibility for it, even though pretty much everybody who's involved is dead. The nation has said, this happened. This is a stain on our past. We are not going to pretend it didn't happen. We will be open and honest about it. And it's allowed that to, it's not an issue that comes up.
Right.
You know, there isn't that sense that there's an avoidance of talking about it and that, you know, that people are just going, oh yeah, no, it's just, you know, it's fine. And so it doesn't cause that bitterness. There's not the victims of it aren't going, well, it's terrible, they're not taking any responsibility. So it doesn't remain in the news because of that. And yeah, I think that's because of that sense that it was addressed, remains something that is taught and people are educated about.
That's a very good point. And I completely agree. I think it's one of those things that if we just talk about, it's like being in a relationship. You know, if you keep everything pent up that bothers you and you don't express how you're feeling or any type of remorse, it just keeps it's pent up and it's like a pressure cooker and it's just trying to get out, and eventually it will. And usually under those circumstances it doesn't end very well. And I think that if we just let it out and get it over with and just move on, I think we could be in a much better place. Somehow, though, we've lost, you know, sight of that. I think you could make the argument that we were equally as horrendous to a group of people as Germany was. I think that the Holocaust and the American slave trade are on equal footing in terms of atrocity. I think that argument could easily be made.
You could make the argument. I think it's a dangerous argument to make, but it's one that I can, it's an alluring argument. The problem with doing it is that it then possibly could lessen both of them. I think you're taking two separate appalling events that changed, you know, the future for millions and millions of people. And you can say, you know, this had a negative impact on X number of people, and this had a negative impact on X number of people. And I suppose when it comes down to numbers, you could, you know, start to make an argument that the effects have been as long lasting for those, you know, similar amounts of people.
Sure.
But it's the difficulty is that it then, you know, from what, even from what I just said then, it comes down to, you know, it's based on numbers and, you know, the way people are treated. It comes down to, you know, forced movement of people. It comes down to treating some people as being less valuable because they're not like you or I.
Mm-hmm. Murder.
And there's a link there. The two things, you know, have got something in common there. The forced removal from place to place. I think what the Nazis did was straight up evil. But then they thought that what they were doing was right. And I think what the slavers did was straight up evil, but they could justify it to themselves through their religious beliefs. And I think one thing, I suppose the thing we can take from both of them is that as a species, we're very good at justifying appalling behavior to ourselves.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I mean, and the thing is, similar things happened around the world.
Sure.
You know, and similar events happened that caused the displacement and deaths of millions and millions of people. It's a really difficult topic to approach.
It is.
Because the Holocaust is a horrendous event.
No question.
And it's no one wants to kind of take away from how awful it was. And I'm very conscious that I'm treading very carefully with the way I'm wording things, because
absolutely,
it's just so easy for people to take things out of context.
Absolutely.
And I think partly there's maybe that whole thing that you just don't, nobody wants to compare things to it for fear of being seen to lessen it.
And that makes sense. That's well said, I think.
Yeah. And it's a horrendous thing. But we also need to be able to accept that other horrendous things have happened. It's not like a competition between them. Mm-hmm. But I suppose that one's possibly, you know, sits there so kind of casting a shadow over everything even now, because it affected so many people in an era where there was, you know, reporting, and you could find out what was happening around the world. It's the first of those kind of things to have happened in what was turning into the modern world. So it feels more real because we've got photographs of it happening and we've got film footage of it. And we know people whose grandparents went through it. There's still that living link to it.
Very good point.
Whereas I think with possibly like with slavery and, you know, other things that have happened, you know, over the years, that there isn't that living link to it anymore. So we're able to box it away as being something that, yes, that was awful, but it's in the past. Whereas with the Holocaust, it still is relatively recent for us. It's something, I mean, I'm 45 now and I was born in 1972. So what would that have been? 30? So the war was, the distance between me now and when I was born is greater, the distance than between the end of the war and me being born.
Wow,
and
that's wild.
It's a crazy thing to think about. It's insane to think about that. And it, because when these things have happened before you were born, they just seem just so abstract and so long ago. It doesn't matter that, you know, like the Beatles split up like a year, 2 years before I was born. I mean, that's just crazy to think that it was the 60s, 3 years before I was born.
Wow.
And, you know, that kind of, and I think as you get older, you get more kind of perspective on the length of time. But I think this is the thing. It's something that the Holocaust is very, very recent, and it's still, the ripples from it are still kind of going out around the world.
Sure.
And, you know, there's the things that led to it are now starting to rear their ugly heads again.
Absolutely.
Around the world.
Yeah.
It's a kind of terrifying thing that you kind of think, well, hang on a second, are we going to repeat this? You know, is it this 70-year cycle where everybody who was involved with something is dead, so the next generation has no physical connection to it anymore and then makes the same mistake again?
I thought up until 2016 that, you know, very naively, but the world was making steps in the right direction towards, you know, kind of a more peaceful and blended and, you know, just tolerant, especially with having, you know, Obama. And whether you like him or you don't, he was a pinnacle in American history because, you know, stemming from what we were just talking about, slavery. And we just elected a African-American president twice. And to me, I stand back and I'm like, hey, you know, bad things can happen in your history, but you can get through it. And then in 2016, it's like I woke up on November the 9th in a completely different nation that I never knew existed. You know, I didn't know the amount of bigoted people that existed until they elected Donald Trump, almost like a twilight zone where nothing's real, up is down, and truths have alternate aspects to them now.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, the same thing happened in the UK with the Brexit vote. And I've been trying to think of what's caused these things. And it feels almost like it's the last gasp of a generation that knows that people who are young now aren't going to do that. You know, that young people are far more tolerant and far more liberal, regardless of their background. I mean, this is the same thing. It's the same thing that leads to things like ISIS and Islamic extremism, is that the people doing it are very, very aware that the next generation after them are far more tolerant. And it's their last attempt to try and really get everything riled up, because they know that if they fail, that's it. They have failed. And I think the right know that as well. Because the people who are attracted to the right, it's still a minority. They're a loud minority, but they are still a minority. And because they're so loud, because they're so influential at the moment, it's demoralizing and worrying for those of us who aren't like that. But the majority of people, I think, are basically good.
I would agree.
And I think that goes across the board, wherever you are, whichever country you live in, whatever your religion is, most people are basically okay and want to just get on with their lives and don't want to hurt anybody else, and they don't want to be hurt. But you've got the fanatics who want to impose their opinion on others. And it's the same in the right and the, you know, people like ISIS and stuff. They're very, very similar to each other in the way they behave and the way they radicalize people.
How do people in the UK view the president?
He's extremely unpopular.
Excellent.
He's seen pretty much universally, apart from a small number of people who are right wing who seem to think he's amazing. Amongst the general population, he's seen as an embarrassment to America. We are embarrassed on your behalf.
I'm glad.
Terrible. He's doing nothing on. But this seems to be from what I've learned from speaking to people around the world, that seems to be the global opinion of him. If the rest of the world thinks he's an idiot, it's amazing. In a year and a bit, he's done so much to damage America's standing in the world. It's crazy. I mean, we're at the point now where you look back at George W. and go, "Oh, yes. He was so presidential."
Yes.
Oh, I wish George W. was still president.
Oh my God, yes.
Yeah, because I mean, he looks like Gandhi compared to Trump. and Bush was an incompetent, warmongering idiot.
Absolutely. We thought that he was the, you know, that you couldn't get any worse or, but you're right. I mean, I would give anything to have W back up on a podium, mispronouncing words. Like, that was what we used to think was newsworthy and basis for which we didn't think he should be president. Now it is a completely different game. I mean, we are talking about a man that just is not in the same reality as anyone else. I mean, he is just on a completely different planet. And I truly don't think that he knows just how bad of a job he's doing. He's clueless.
He seems to be oblivious. I mean, it's going back to the whole comparing bad with worse. When it started to look like maybe the Republicans would choose Mitt Romney as their candidate, it was almost like, oh, thank God. Mitt Romney, he's presidential.
I would be fine with Mitt Romney right now.
Yeah, I mean, and 5 years ago, we'd have been like, dear God, no. We were like, he's an appalling candidate, and he was, and he still is. But comparatively, he's like gold compared to Trump.
It's like George Washington.
he's the best ever compared to Trump. I mean, Trump is so bad that he has elevated the mediocre to the level of genius in comparison, and he's the terrible to the level of acceptable, because he's just recalibrated everything so low. He set the bar so low that everybody else just can't help but shine next to him.
I think he's done actually more than that. The way that I see it is, the news is so used to now having daily stories, and the spotlight is always on the president. He's always doing this because, let's be honest, that's good for ratings. So I think what's going to happen is there's going to be this almost void for drama when Trump gets there. And I think that's going to alter, sadly, the presidency, because now you have actual serious conversations between news media outlets and on shows of a Oprah versus Trump card. Now, 10 years ago, if you would have said Oprah versus Trump, you would have been laughed out of whatever conversation that you were having.
Yeah.
But it's changed so drastically now that we want an Oprah versus Trump just because we want to watch that slaughter between the two of them go down.
Yeah. And this is a good example in the UK. There was a show that is on the BBC News channel that was initially called 100 Days, that was meant to be just covering the first 100 days of the presidency. And it's now been on for well over a year. It's called Beyond 100 Days, and it's on four nights a week in primetime slot on BBC News channel.
Wow.
Because there's just always something to talk about. And I was talking about this with my partner and saying, you know, do you think the show will continue once Trump's gone? And from what you're saying, it's possible that that kind of thing will continue. Part of me hopes that we'll come to our collective senses and push back against this. The worry is that this is the way things are going forward, and they will continue to be like this. The hope is that this is the last kind of spasm of that post-war generation. And the people who feel that they're entitled to stamp their authority on others. Hopefully it's the end of that. And, you know, in 100 years' time, people will look back and go, wow, that was a little bit of a weird time. The scary thing is that it might not, and there might be a real slide back into things. I mean, I think it's Bermuda has started a campaign to reverse their laws about gay marriage. It's an appalling thing. It's that these things that were really kind of progressive and making us as a species better, they're now, people are starting to go, oh, let's take those rights away from others.
It's crazy.
Yeah, it's very, very strange. But I personally don't care what people do or think or say, as long as they're not harming other people. So I don't care what people believe religiously. I don't care what they do in the bedroom. I don't care what their politics are, as long as they're not hurting other people.
Right.
It's when they start to kind of force those things. And by definition, fascism and right-wing thinking is forcing your view on others.
Absolutely.
And it's the same with ISIS and the other extremists on that side are equally fascist. Anything where you're saying you must behave this way or I will hurt you is wrong.
Absolutely.
But then I'm aware of the kind of contradiction in that, because I will still laugh when I see somebody like Richard Spencer punched, because
he deserves it.
Yeah, but this is the thing. He deserves it, but I'm aware that I'm a hypocrite finding that funny, because I don't feel that that anybody should be punched for what they say. But at the same time, I think some people have maybe given up the right to not be punched by having ideas that are so abhorrent.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
But then the argument comes back from them, saying, well, who are you to decide what's abhorrent? And it's a good point. You know, really difficult situation. We're in a difficult situation, but I think certain things like, you know, being a neo-Nazi are fairly well established as being unacceptable.
Yeah, you deserve to get punched. I'm sorry. I wouldn't consider you a hypocrite, because I think that there's a certain marker that you pass, and whether, you know, people can bring up the argument, you know, or who are you to say where the marker is. But I think if you stripped everybody down and got them to their honest self, we could all agree on what we wouldn't want happen to ourselves. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think when you cross that line, then, like you said, you give up your right to be offended if somebody comes up and punches you because you say a bunch of racist, anti-Semitic things. I mean,
I think it was Karl Popper that wrote about the paradox of tolerance, that there's certain things you can't tolerate.
Absolutely.
Because if you do tolerate those things, then the person you have tolerated will then take away your right to do things. You're enabling their intolerance, and you're basically saying, no, it's fine, take away my rights.
Good point.
You know, if you don't stand up to neo-Nazis, then you're effectively saying, no, it's fine. Because as soon as they're in power, they will strip you of your rights and they will do whatever they want.
Absolutely.
And they will not be tolerant towards you.
Absolutely.
Under any circumstances. So, yeah, it's this whole kind of the paradox of intolerance that you know, some things, you have to be intolerant of some things if you're overall going to be attempt to make a tolerant society. But it's humans are just messed up.
They are. The one thing that that I will give Trump, and my one, I don't want to call it a compliment, but my one not in the horrible column, is that at least he is out in the open and transparent with his bigotry. You know what I mean? Like, it's almost, to me, I think I would rather see it like that than the ones who get up behind that podium, like, you know, a bunch of the congressmen and senators who are just, you can just tell they're vile people, but they smile and they say the right things. They articulate well. At least Trump, you know, for what he is, he puts it out there in the open and he doesn't really care if you...
The refreshing honesty to his bigotry and racism.
Almost, yeah. As horrible as that is to say, yeah.
Yeah, at least you can recognize it in him. I mean, I think you're right. He's not very good at kind of subtle dog whistles or anything like that, whereas there's that kind of nastiness that's sort of sits, you know, with other people where they are very good at the dog whistling. You know, when people talk about sort of, oh, George Soros this and George Soros that, you know, we all know that that's a barely hidden dog whistle about Jews.
Right. Absolutely.
You know, that's old as the hills, that conspiracy and that feeling of, you know, othering of Jews. But people think, oh, that we're being very clever, we're not kind of saying it outright. But yeah, it's not that clever. But it can pull people in who will go, well, I'm not anti-Semitic, I'm not racist, I'm not this, I'm not that. Because they've convinced themselves that they're not, because they think the same thing, but they word it to themselves differently. So they can convince themselves that they're not racist. Oh, Islam isn't a race, so I'm not racist. Right. Well, how do you recognize somebody who's a Muslim? Okay, you've got two people stood in front of you. One of them's of Middle Eastern descent, and one of them's of Northern European descent. Which one's the Muslim? And they're going to say, well, I think it's the Middle Eastern guy. Well, hang on a second. That is why Islamophobia is a form of racism, because you are going to categorize somebody based on their skin color.
Right.
Yeah, and they're going to do that whether they think about it or not. And I've done it myself. I have got into arguments with people saying Islam isn't a race. Mm-hmm. I got into an argument on Twitter with the British comedian Limmy, that it popped up on my, I found it on Twitter and I was like, oh my God, that makes me look like an absolute twat, because I'd worded what I was trying to say very poorly and was coming at it from the point of view that there's no way that I considered being anti-religion being anti-race, but now I can see the subtleties of it. I can see that it can be seen that way, and that in a lot of respects, that when you look at it in the context of the things these people say, the other things they say, you think, yeah, actually, that's just straight up naked racism.
The beauty of this conversation is that although we went off on, you know, kind of a tangent on the right and racism and kind of the rise of that field, which I think is important, but it ties in so perfectly to your book, because we're at a time now where truth is subjective. I mean, it's not subjective, but that's the way that it's looking to me. Like now truth is not a definable thing. There are alternate facts, and we have a president that gets up and literally lies every single day. And amidst of all that, it's kind of a beautiful thing to see something like this spring up, and it's raw, and it's the complete truth, and it's, you know, it's unabashed and not hiding. And I think that it's relevant and a really good timing to do something like this.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say that, you know, you're saying it's the complete truth. It's certainly my complete truth. Whether it's the truth is another matter. Exactly. But there's going to be some things in it that are probably objectively untrue. But from my position, I believe them to be true. But, you know, to me, it is an objective truth that I don't like peas. That is true. I think peas are disgusting. So to me, that is one. It is 100% certain. But to other people, it isn't. So this whole notion of, you know, what is true and what isn't becomes somewhat blurred when you start taking people's subjective opinions on it. It's a yeah, it's a difficult one, this notion of what is true and what isn't. There's going to be part of it that's coming up that I'm going to be writing probably next month or so is actually going to be related to my interactions with people on YouTube and stuff like that. There's going to be stuff in there that's going to touch on the way that people talked about truth. I mean, there's no way that I'm going to get around writing about people like Seitan Brugenkate and my experiences with those people, and then the way that certain other people have gone very much to extremes from positions they were at 3 or 4 years ago.
When you're deciding which stories to include and which ones not, how are you doing that? Like, are you doing it based on what you think will be more interesting to the reader? Or are you putting it in there based on what more impactful to you?
I think it's more about what lends context to what surrounds it. Mm-hmm. That the things that I feel lead on to the next thing. I want there to be, because from my position, I kind of see things as having kind of cause and effect all the way through my life. So I'm trying to write it from the point of view of that. There's little bits that I go off on side things that are more about things that I'm just kind of, that I was interested in, or that my life was revolving around at those times. Like there's the bit I'm in at the moment, I'm writing a lot about being in bands, and I'm cannibalizing work I've written in the past and going back over it because I didn't want to rewrite 25 years worth of stuff about being in bands. Sure. So I've gone back to stuff I'd written in the past and I'm reworking it and adding things into it and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, it kind of swerves off into that. But so the tone shifts at various times in it because it's dealing with what was important to me at those times. So for people reading it, they're going to think, well, hang on a second, this has taken a left turn. Like there's a 20 or 30,000 word section about my experiences in online dating. And, you know, it's just a complete swerve from where it was before.
I haven't gotten there yet.
No, that's still to be written. Well, it's kind of half written, but it's still to be folded into the longer part. So that's going to happen. And then there's going to be this whole section about my experiences in online atheism. You know, it's almost as if there's sections that could be different book, but they are about what was the focus of my life at that time.
Sure.
And I have to kind of try and simplify it in a way for myself, because if I just tried to write everything, then it would be just horrifying. It would be tens of thousands of pages. It would just be awful and it'd be unreadable garbage. So you have to kind of see where the narrative pushes.
There's the answer to your problem right there.
Release book one now and see how it lands, and then do the more recent.
That's something I've had to think about as well, because it's getting longer and longer. The rough version I've got at the moment has got about 120,000 words that are finished, and about another 60 or 70,000 words that just need working on. And that's only going to bring me up to about a decade ago.
Wow.
So,
wow.
And a lot has happened in the last 10 years. So there's going to be a lot to write. So it's just up to 10 years ago, it's going to be at least 200,000 words.
Wow.
It's going to be, I think it's probably going to hit, I might manage to bring it in about 250,000 words. I might be able to.
Wow. I think your YouTube career alone would fill a book.
That's the thing that worries me, is that there's these things that have happened with that, you know, because I don't want to just skim over stuff.
You can't I mean,
you're actually an influence for this pod. I mean, I loved Fundamentally Flawed, which was an excellent podcast.
I'm actually interviewing you about a book that you wrote because of that particular part of your life. So
This is the thing about it. I mean, it's the YouTube years made me known to a lot of people, and positively and negatively. A lot of people felt they had some kind of ownership of me and that they had some right to tell me what to do or to how to think, or, you know, saying, oh, you should be still doing this or you should still be doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Which is really tempting to do for anybody who's in, you know, if you start to become a fan of somebody's work. And I'm aware that this is the same for musicians that I admire and writers that I admire. I'm kind of disappointed when they stop doing things that I like, or they kind of don't do it the way I want them to do it. But it's not my place to think that. It's up to them. And I suppose this is, maybe that's another thing about the way the book's constructed, that it'll show that people's interests do change as they age and as new things happen to them. You know, suddenly something that seemed very important 5 years ago isn't. I mean, it's like, you know, 4.5 years ago, 5 years ago, I would sit and at work listening to podcasts with G-Man. And, you know, I check in the morning to see what G-Man said.
You're describing my life now.
And this is it. And I would do it kind of obsessively.
Yes.
And I'd get kind of dragged into all the dramas about it and things like that. And then this week I saw a podcast. There's been a bit of drama with scientist Sam and Dragnaut and Steve Prey. Yeah, there's been this little bit of drama about that. And I've been watching that and I'm just finding myself thinking, this doesn't matter. Why are people getting, right. Why is anybody even thinking about, why is this hangout happening? This is so unimportant.
Absolutely.
You kind of want to grab people and go, seriously, just look at yourselves. This does not matter.
Right, absolutely.
But I'm aware that several years ago, it mattered to me. So I can understand where they're coming from, but I can also understand it from the point of view being outside of it. But I suppose it's the same with any kind of hobby or obsession that people have. When you're knee deep in it, it seems like the most important thing in the world. Once you're no longer involved, you think, what was that about?
What I don't understand is the need to make a video about a particular person that no one else knows about and or not many people do and ultimately doesn't affect their life or anybody else's life. It's just a video to drone on about, like you said, meaningless shit that doesn't affect anybody's life and alters their existence in no way. How you could do that on a daily basis, I just don't get.
I think it becomes quite attractive, though, because you become... You find yourself having this mouthpiece this amplified soapbox, and you can right the wrongs you perceive as happening to you. And you've got this right to go, well, this person did this and that's not true because blah, blah, blah. It becomes, because people react to that, then you get the comments and then the videos coming back and stuff. It becomes this kind of really hyper magnified, dramatic, but from the point of view of being inside it, this dramatic life that's going on, you know, and you're kind of thinking, oh, what's happening? It's like, you know, you know that somebody like G-Man would be just thinking about it 24/7, really kind of mulling it over and really grinding on it in his mind, instead of going, hang on a second, this is such a tiny part of my life and it's so inconsequential, I'll just ignore it.
Good point.
Yeah, and I think this is what happens. I mean, I know I did that. I kind of became completely, you know, obsessed, and there'd be periods where I'd be kind of up until very late in very long hangouts and stuff, or, you know, seeing what was going on. Oh, what's Brett Keane done? Oh, what's Rand Campbell done? Oh, what's G-Man done? It's like, these people don't matter to anybody. And in the same way as I would say to somebody like G-Man, I don't matter to him. I'm nobody. So worrying about what I think or say is pointless. Nobody gives a shit. The man in the street doesn't give a shit.
Absolutely. But I mean, there's a big difference between, you know, being able to realize that and someone like Brett Keane, who this is an actual existential part of them and their entire, you know, the center of their world. You got to feel relief almost that you are able to get that close to the flame and not get burnt and get caught up into it. Like, you're able to break away from it and say, nope, that's enough, I'm done.
Yeah, I think it's one of these things that, you know, you're saying get away without being burned by it. I'm still in a position where I will be accused of thinking things or saying things I've not said. Certainly, oddly enough, from people who used to sort of see themselves as being kind of allied to me, will often say, oh, he thinks this or he thinks that. Or, you know, I've been accused of being I've been accused of being an apologist for Islam and things like that. And, you know, there's nowhere that I've actually said anything that indicates that I am. You know, the most I've said is like, hang on a second, everybody, this is maybe a little bit more complicated than you're saying. Maybe that's a bit racist and, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Wow.
But, you know, this is the thing. It's I no longer really have to actually have opinions about things because a certain group of people have decided what my opinions are and stick to them.
That's insane. So,
yeah, well, it's just how it is. I mean, I don't know why it is, you know, it's they think that my position on things has changed, and I don't think it has that much. You know, I think that if anything, I've become more tolerant of other people, and certainly part of the reason why I don't have arguments with Christians about things anymore is because I just don't care.
Sure.
You know, they're willing, so I can believe whatever he likes. You know, he's not convincing anybody. Everybody now has the tools to deal with him. You know, big deal. We can figure about him. And so I feel like what I was doing back then is finished with. I've done it. I've done what I set out to do, and I don't need to do anything more. But there's I think maybe some people, and maybe it comes back to the whole notion of, you know, people wanting you to keep on doing what you were doing, that there's that sense of, you know, maybe I've betrayed people by not continuing to be what they wanted me to be. And maybe they feel that I've changed because of that, because their expectation of me is different to the reality of me. But you can't stay kind of stuck in that.
Agreed.
that kind of rut. You can't keep yourself kind of like sealed in amber forever in a certain way. And this is something that comes out in the book, that it changes as my focus changes over the years. You know, there's a reason why a big chunk of it's about being in bands. There's a reason why a big chunk of it's kind of about religion. There's a reason why a big chunk of it's about, you know, a disproportionate chunk covers a space of about 2 years of internet dating. But that's what my focus was at the time. You know, my life was shaped by those events at those times. You know, for X amount of years, it was shaped by being in bands and everything was around that. Then for that couple of years, it was shaped by my experiences of online dating and things like my jobs and stuff like that, though they were still happening, were very kind of minor parts of my narrative at that point. Then for a few years, they were shaped by YouTube and that kind of stuff. And it's, you know, people don't want you to change from those positions. You know, it's like with the music thing, I still have people come to me and say, oh, I liked it when you used to do this. And it's like, that's 20 years ago. I don't do that anymore. I have no interest in doing that anymore. Or I wish you'd do stuff like that. Or I wish you'd still do songs that had tunes and stuff like this. But my interest is no longer in that position.
Right.
So I can understand how people feel let down, and especially if they've felt invested.
I don't see anything wrong with change. I think to evolve is a good thing. If you notice that the people that oftentimes are the ones that are perpetually caught up in drama are the ones that don't. They're the ones that are still in the same position that they were in 10 years ago.
Have you noticed since your time on YouTube, because back then it was a lot more focused on the religion aspect of the debate. Now it's moved into a social justice warrior alt-right kind of...
Yeah, and it's really weird. I mean, I was looking at Beckles G Plus feed the other day, and it's a mirror image of some of the stuff I see from right wingers. It's really? Well, not even a mirror image. It's just a, you know, like for like. The same things are being posted, and you know, the same kind of stuff about liberals, and the same stuff about social justice warriors, and the same stuff about Islam, and the same stuff about, you know, this, that, and the other.
Interesting.
The way that those two sides have intersected and found a common ground is kind of an interesting thing to look at. But, you know,
it's scary.
yeah. But it's kind of quite interesting how extremist thinking finds its level. And usually the level is the same as people who they were previously opposed to.
That's fascinating to think about.
Yeah, it's an interesting development. That, you know, the same people who 5 years ago would have been saying, how dare a baker not make a cake for a same-sex couple, are now saying, oh, it's great that this judge decided not to make a cake, told them that this baker didn't have to make a cake for a same-sex couple. I think the judge has done the right thing. It's this weird shift.
That is a good point.
The things that they were absolutely against a few years ago, they're, you know, I hate to use the word because it's, you know, it's become something that people use a lot. Their Overton window has moved to the point where they are almost exactly the same as the people they stood against a few years ago. And they've not realized it because it's been such a gradual drip, drip, drip of tiny little things that it's led to them becoming this without them realizing it.
People are so weird.
They could say the same of me. I mean, it may well have, that it's happened to me. That could be the case. I could have changed my position without realizing it. Yeah. And because it's been a subtle drip, 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 and I've not noticed it. And I think we're all capable of having that happen to us. I've no solution to that. But
yeah, but Alex, are you using your reasoning and logic to come to that conclusion?
how do I know that?
Last question. When can people expect to be able to buy this book?
So I've set myself the end of March as the deadline to finish the first draft of it, which is possibly quite optimistic. I mean, as we're, you know, a third of the way through February already, and I've got a lot to go through. But hopefully by the end of March, I'll have a version that has got the basic shape of it. Then my plan is to get a single copy of it printed for myself, get it printed A4, ring bound, so I can then go through it with a pen and change things and fix things. But what I'll do is I'll print it, then I will leave it for a month and not look at it. Then I'll come back and read it from cover to cover and make alterations then. Then once I'm happy with that and I've made the edits, then at that point, it'll be the point where I start to decide whether I'm going to change names and how I'm going to approach it, and whether I think it's something that is worth trying to get published or not.
Yes, you have to publish this, Alex.
Yeah. I mean, so, I mean, it's one of these things. I mean, it'll, one way or another, it'll be available for people to read. And that will probably be the end of the summer. If the earliest it will be the end of the summer. And that'll be if no professional publishers are interested in it, you know, then it will be then, because then I'll get it self-published via one of the online websites. So people will be able to buy a book of it. So the earliest you're going to get it is maybe August, September. Around June or July, I will be letting a small number of people have copies of it to get feedback on it before it goes to the next bit. So I'll make sure you get a copy of it by that point. So you'll have hopefully you'll have a completed copy. But I'll kind of give it to people under the strict instructions they don't share it with anybody else.
Sure. And, yeah, absolutely. You
know, it's one of these things that I don't want it getting out before I'm ready.
Absolutely not. I mean, yeah. I don't want to get it out before you're ready either.
No, I'm not saying that you would do that. It's just, you know, it's because I'm sure there's some people who just think, oh, can't wait to get this. I'm going to get all the dirt on him. You will, but the dirt will be stuff that I will have had control over.
Yeah, you can't use it then. You know what I mean? Like, it's not dirt anymore. You know?
Yeah, if somebody says, oh, you did this, it's like, right. Yeah.
I told you.
You know that because I admitted to it and I've made no secret of that. Yeah, but you did this and that was terrible. Yeah, and I've written about it there. Yes, and it's awful. Yeah, and that's on page 300.
Oh, like, that's genius.
So, I mean, it takes ownership, but
yeah,
going right back to what we said at the start, there's the risk. And I think that's what I'll have to start considering once I'm finished and I've got a version of it that I'm happy with for other people to read as a completed work. That'll be when I start thinking, well, how do I approach this?
How do I back out?
No. I have to do it. I have to finish it. I have to make it so that people can read it because, you know, I'm not sure which side it is. On one side, I think it's worthwhile. On the other side, I need to fire my ego. So whichever one is driving me to finish it, I need to do it. So. Right.
I appreciate you letting me on the ride. I thoroughly enjoy it. And I think there will be many, many, many that do. And actually, I'd like to have you back on after you release it to kind of discuss the aftermath. You know,
when I'm a kind of friendless loser who's unemployed and living in a box on a street corner because I've alienated everybody in my life. Yeah, no, I'll come back at that point and tell you just how. I suppose the thing is that I may be in a position where in 5 years' time I've got enough to write about what happened with it. So,
oh, you will, yeah. I think. There's some aspects of the story, I think, that, to use the term viral, I guess, could go viral within your circle. You know, like maybe somebody that you haven't spoken to in a long time will somehow get a copy and read, and that will be a way that you guys can reconnect or, you know, rekindle something that was lost years ago. So, I mean, you never know how it'll turn out. It could be completely different than what you think going in.
It's going to be an interesting couple of years. At least, I'm guessing at least there'll be some lengthy hangouts about it. So. At the very least.
Excellent. It'll keep me busy.
Yes, indeed.
Well, Alex, man, I appreciate you taking the time to speak with me. This was, as always, a fantastic conversation. And I am one of those people that wishes you were still doing the Alex Botton thing on YouTube, but you're right. I have to respect your desire to move on.
This is the thing. I mean, that part of me still exists, but I've made it slightly more difficult to find because it was never to me about getting attention or subscribers or anything like that. It was never, you know, what can I do to get clicks? You know, I don't want to force what I think about things on other people. So in the last 2 years, I've done a lot of stuff which just isn't on YouTube, and there's hours and hours and hours of stuff. There's about, in total, there's about 30 odd hours of material I've put out in the last 2 years. That's, some of it is, you know, what would have been YouTube videos back in the day, but it isn't, and it's less easy to find because I want it to be, if people are interested, they can go and find it, not feel that they should watch it because it's got my name attached to it or something like that.
All right, Alex, well, you have a good evening, and I appreciate it. It was great as always.
Nice talking to you, Carl. Right. Cheers. Bye-bye.
And I appreciate you, the listeners, for taking the time out of your day to listen to this podcast. If you have any suggestions, questions, comments, we love them all. We're constantly trying to improve the show and make it the best possible podcast and make it entertaining, engaging, and informative. You can email us at live@nonsecshow.com. That's nonsecshow.com. Same with the website, nonsecshow.com. Go there for videos, upcoming guests, shows, and any other kind of information that you would want to know. The next episode will feature Aaron Ra in an explosive interview that we had with him. And I'm excited to announce that on March the 1st at 7 o'clock Eastern, we will have Aaron Ra back on to have a discussion with the infamous Kent Hovind. The two will finally meet to discuss the two best proofs for evolution. So don't miss that. Again, that's March 18th at 7 o'clock Eastern Time. For Non Sequitur, I'm Kyle Curtis, and remember, everyone, be bold, dream on, and never, ever hide. Until next time.